Hi, everybody. It's Matt and Justin. We're here on location at the Health AI Week at Stanford Medicine.
And we're going deeper with a few of those speakers on the Stanford AI in Healthcare podcast.
So we hope you'll join us for the next few episodes where we'll be, again, speaking with some of the leaders in industry, healthcare, and AI and life sciences.
I was having a debate with Zeke Emanuel.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're all here super excited about AI, the potential. Already, I think we would argue, I'm curious if you agree with this, is having the biggest impact on patients. Understanding, knowledge, access to information, a leveling, like that is already happening today. Where I'm curious, and I was struggling, is given that we believe that, you're also a quality person, how will we be able to measure this? How will we be able to measure the impact of what I think we believe is the positive impact for patients? How will we know at like a national level, how will we be able to measure it?
Well, I think we have to start researching. I mean, so much research is done right now on AI and clinicians and AI in healthcare systems and the impact on efficiency and cost savings and all that. There has been little research on patient use of AI, who's doing it, when we do it, how are we doing it, why are we doing it? I mean, no one is collecting this data. And it is, I think, some of the richest information for us to learn. And that when this research is developed, and I think it's just on the horizon, quite frankly, because I think we are some of the biggest users of AI. I think we are like outpacing the healthcare system. And so I think when this research when whoever decides to research this, they need patients at the table because we need to help design the research questions. You know, what would that research look like? And we need to base it on the outcomes that matter to us. So that's, you know, I think that is fertile territory.
Is this going to be like a public, I mean, because like the different vendors have obviously lots of data on their users. I mean, they may not share all of it all the time, but like there's been some interesting reports like, you know, I think it was OpenAI that showed like a map of the U.S. and then sort of had like, you know, access to care in one sort of angle and then the number of chats about healthcare. Yeah. And it was pretty well correlated. And so I think this maybe begs for, to your point, can we learn a little bit more about the use cases, where they're working, where they're getting stuck? Like, it seems like we could give them a boost. They're already seeing so many opportunities.
You know, something I would love to see in research, I mean, like I mentioned and other speakers mentioned that diagnostic safety is a huge national problem. It kills or permanently harms about 900,000 Americans a year. And so I would love to see an AI organization or AI developer dig it, mine their data, look for the trends in the diagnostic process that patients go on with AI. I've gone on a diagnostic process with AI, and it's not just one question. It's a journey, and then it remembers me. And so I would love for an AI company to dive into their, mine their trends, and then my organization, Patients for Patient Safety US, we have access to thousands of patients. And so why not bring in the real patients who have experienced harm with what AI companies are learning in their trends, get together, and form something, you know, do some research and then form something to solve this problem.
How have the conversations been so far? Have you tried approaching the Frontier Labs? Obviously, you're here at Stanford. You know, you can talk to academia. You've done this. Frontier Labs are new, right, to healthcare on this. Have you had those discussions? How has that gone so far, trying to engage them on that?
You know, I know others in, you know, Google and Microsoft and that, and I would love to sit down and just have this conversation. Quite frankly, my organization was just thinking, like last week, how do we solve this problem of missed, wrong, and delayed diagnosis that harms so many people? AI is the answer. And so we need a partner. And this is what we're just kind of formulating. And I actually went into ChatGPT and said, ChatGPT, envision a partnership with the AI, with OpenAI is what I put. Mm-hmm. You know, envision a partnership. What would we do together? It was fascinating.
As Justin and the people who ever watch our show know, like I am extremely bullish on the idea that this is transforming the patient experience writ large. The fact that we spend, you know, whatever, 15 maybe if we're lucky minutes with a patient, do I even know by the time they leave, like, have they comprehended enough? Am I answering all their questions? All the things. And then on my side, am I up to speed enough to really address all the things that they're going to ask? It's been a game. I also feel like it's been pushing the health systems in a way that I've never seen before, because the technology is so accessible and so useful that health systems are kind of like almost on their back foot a little bit. Have you heard from patients in your organizations that are like, I don't know what to do. I go to my doctor and they seem to be less knowledgeable than I am now that I've been working with these tools, and it feels as though I'm lacking someone that can help guide me through what right and wrong is, because I don't know if I should trust just AI. Do I trust my helper? You know, like, is there a...
We do hear a lot from patients who use AI, and most of it's very positive. And, you know, they use it. Why are they using AI? We have to ask ourselves this question, first of all. You know, first of all, access. You know, I live in Frontier, Idaho. I don't have access to, I can't see a primary next week. It'll take months, a specialist even longer. And so, first of all, you know, access is a huge problem. Second of all, AI, you know, there's a epidemic of patients and family members' concerns getting dismissed. You know what? AI can't dismiss me. And, you know, AI remembers me. I've gone into doctor's office who know, well, I thought they knew me, and then they walk in and they have no, you know, memory of my history. Well, I can go on to chat, and chat's like, oh, it knows all my background. It remembers me. And, you know, and so there's so many reasons why patients are, it's got all the time in the world, like you said. So, I mean, first of all, we have to really learn why are patients using AI, and what is this gap that's getting filled by AI? It's a big gap. So when we get to the physicians, yes, sometimes patients do arrive with maybe more of their own data from wearables, from whatever, and more data that they've learned from, more information. So this democratization of data and knowledge, we arrive as a different patient these days. And so we're calling for, you know, a different relationship with our provider, different partnership, that I think that's where the sweet spot is, quite frankly.
And maybe I'll use this opportunity to ask the question we're asking everyone, which is, what is the constraint holding your vision back for how AI could change how healthcare looks like? What is the constraint that if you could remove, would really run things forward?
Culture.
Say more.
I think that, you know, right now what I'm observing is in the media, in commentaries, in journals, we're seeing all this negative positioning of patients using AI, that, you know, they classify us and label us as midnight moms and all these patients that are fictitional. They're not really engaging real patients. And so they're positioning patients as the problem instead of the solution. I think we're the solution. And so I think culture, you know, like when I used AI and it solved a big problem for me. It was on the front page of New York Times. It went viral in a blog. I was heavily criticized in LinkedIn, on every social media channel, because, you know, doctors were calling me doctor shoppers, and that I shouldn't be challenging my doctor. And so I was shocked at that response. And so culture, we've got to change the culture in terms of what the media says. You know, my husband is a clinician, so I respect clinicians, but I think there's a lot of bias when they talk about patients using AI. You know, instead of rolling their eyes and calling us a problem, they should celebrate an informed patient.
Can't agree more. I mean, yeah.
I don't know how we follow that.
But the meta point here, I think, as we wrap is, you know, I think there has been harm, not just in the healthcare AI narrative, but societal narrative, right? I think that you're seeing the pushback on data center buildouts, a lot of misinformation being put around the build out, what they're used for, the impact of the environment of the economy, and of course, the job narrative. I don't think it's been helpful for anyone working in this technology, the way the narrative had sort of started. You can start to see it shift now, I think, and as people are beginning to become more used to using it in their work or in their personal lives. But to your point, this is all a culture problem that we're going to have to figure out.
And we have to acknowledge, I mean, I look at AI through a patient safety angle and getting the right diagnoses, because two of my family members were harmed. I lost a husband when his malignant pathology got lost. AI could have caught that. And then I have a son, 31, who suffered brain damage from his newborn jaundice when everything fell through the crack, AI could have caught it. So I see it through an AI lens. And, you know, we actually live in a healthcare, get our healthcare in a healthcare system that really is unsafe. So when people try to position patients as, oh, they're going to believe everything AI says, well, you know what? I believe the doctors. And, you know, it's so I think we have to level set and understand that our healthcare system really isn't designed to help clinicians do their best. You know, they got 12 minutes. They've got, you know, all these restrictions. That's why patients are stepping in.
Yeah. And I love that as a spot to wrap, which is, can we measure diagnostic errors and see them going down?
Yes.
With the introduction of AI.
Yes.
And like as a metric that we think AI can improve, again, from both patients bringing their own information and to clinicians, I love that as a focus.
Absolutely, I do. And, you know, this has kind of been an excuse for a long time. Oh, we can't measure it. Yes, we can. And, you know, one of the measures that's just been missing a big gap is patient-reported measures. There is no mechanism yet to learn from us. You know, when the diagnostic errors happened to Cal and Pat and me, there was nothing to collect that data. I was eager to share that because I didn't want that to happen again. Well, we're changing that. You know, the group, my group is working with HHS and others. We've been doing some research on, you know, changing that. And so that's a layer of data. That's a new layer of data. And then, you know, with technology and other measures are now going to be easier to capture.
I'm excited for it. Thank you for all the great work you're doing. Yeah. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
In my mind, the technology is going to evolve, and you're going to have companies like ours that figure out, either because folks are doing it bottoms up or top down investments, they're going to figure out how to use it, and we're going to figure out where to make the investment. Ultimately, it's what happens when you start making those investments, and what do people do? It's the cultural change associated with it, because that's the thing that I used to have a lot more hair. When you start making hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of investment, today I approved another $100 million investment in AI, then you're like, okay, why is it that these projects aren't moving faster? What's happening around, you know, I could go off on this.
No, can you go? I think they're rolling, so just like, they will just, cut and move.
Just to be sure, we encourage rants and going off on this show all the time, so please.
Because the thing that is so frustrating to me is that, you know, we're putting massive amounts of resources around projects like, okay, how do we minimize the quality issues in a manufacturing site? There's actually a really good New York Times article 2 or 3 weeks ago on our Devens facility where we're doing it at scale. And I can count on one hand the number of New York Times articles that are positive on pharma. And so to have an entire New York Times article on pharma, where it's like, look at what this one manufacturing site is doing in AI. It was great. But the precursor to all of that is you're doing a ton of investment, and the teams will spend millions and millions of dollars, and they're like, well, we might be able to shave off about a half a day on this. And you're like, no. At some point, we got to start putting like real numbers and actual impact. Investors in our space have gone from, are you doing anything in AI? To, what are you getting for it? And all of this is tied up in, one, people don't know what they don't know. The same thing you guys mentioned, that this stuff's moving so fast. A lot of folks just don't even keep pace with what's happening. Two, when they start using it, they're like, oh, this is really interesting. We could do a lot of, you can see their brain start moving. Then you put real money behind it, and they're like, well, I don't want to be held accountable for the output on this stuff. I just want to spend the money. So we got to get that happening. And then when there's a lot of resources behind it, folks start going, where's this going? What does that mean for me and my teams? So then you have to start having that conversation. And that's where you got to be really thoughtful about how you engage. So,
I mean, it's a large org. And I mean, when I was at Microsoft, like that was our whole bread and butter. We meet with large healthcare organizations in all different sectors. And there were always little like pockets of people that were like, AI pilled is the term out here, but whatever it is, like they're so excited about it and they can't wait to do everything. And then you have other folks that are like, I looked at it a year ago. It was okay, but it really wasn't as good as I thought. So I'm good. And it's like, to your point, how do you encourage writing that understanding, the constant checking on, okay, can it do this now? Can it do this now? at the same time as keeping people on track.
Yeah.
For like, hey, we actually have to deliver this, and we need to show where the delta was for using the tools. Like, you've got the idea person who's got 50 million projects, and you've got the person's like, eh, you're gonna drag me along. And then there's a spectrum. Like, organizationally, how do you, what's the metrics, incentives, like, how do you work with that?
Well, there's no easy answer to it, for sure. But you're right. You have these folks who are early adopters. They're enthusiastic in their copious spare time. They read about AI. They see where it's going. They're the ones who sit down and partner with our digital transformation officer, and they're staying up to speed on things. Then you have folks who are like, I have a real job, and I got to do stuff, and I don't have time for this. And then in our industry, you also have, it's heavily regulated, and so you got tons of lawyers and tons of process. And so you got to kind of break that problem down and say, okay, how do you keep these projects moving? When you find that there's proof of concept, you scale them, and how do you get the organization out of the way to be able to implement them and derive value? And there's no simple way to do that, but it does come down to those evangelists you have to continue to incent them to drive this forward. You will find that an organization of the size of Bristol Myers Squibb, with 30,000 people, we operate globally, we've been around 170 years and all the wiring and plumbing that goes with that. And so what happens is somebody has to be accountable for just breaking through organizational barriers wherever they come. We're very fortunate that digital transformation officer didn't come from pharma. So when the first models of ChatGPT were coming out in November 22, we almost did what every pharma colleague of ours did, which is let's surround it by lawyers and process and strangle it until we're forced eventually to actually do something with it. And he said, please don't do that. And so after a very long engaged discussion, we ended up putting ChatGPT, that first model, on about 1,000 of our executives' toolkit. And what began to emerge were kind of use cases. Well, now we have every morning you log in, 34,000 people have access to a whole suite of AI tools. And the idea was, let's let 1,000 flowers bloom. Let's just get those ideas moving. You can execute them. If they're good, we'll put some money behind them. And so that's worked. And then what we said is, okay, over time, there are some areas across the big verticals, manufacturing, research, development, commercialization. We got to put more resources in, and we're going to start pushing down not only computing power, but specific tools that we think can drive the mission of the organization. And then for each of those, you then have to stay on top of, how much are we spending? Are we getting a return? Who's going to drive these projects? Because you get to the morass of the middle layers of the organization. You got to blow through it. It's coming back up to my level, because I was literally just having a conversation with one of our employees on a topic, and I'm like, send me an email, because I can break through some of that if necessary. Uh-huh. There's no simple solution. It's just it's constant diligence.
But it's in the trying that you're like, that's the progress. Like, it's almost like, but the paralysis, and I know we've talked about this before, but the shadow IT problem, everyone's got it on their phone. They know what it's capable of. They also know what their use cases are and their role. Like, it's not hard to see the opportunity, but if there's all these, again, processes or bans or, in healthcare, I always say the story where I would, after ChatGPT came out, one of the health systems I worked with said, we are not going to be able to access it on our hospital computers anymore, like, or period. And so folks, residents, overnight residents, were tethering their laptops to their phone to be able to use it because it's so useful, right?
And the problem with that is you end up with shadow organizations. Exactly. Now, so now you're spending twice as much as you thought you were spending. Exactly. And unfortunately, when you have those shadow organizations, oftentimes, we spend a lot of time building some of these tools ourselves because they're customized. We connect them to our data. We curate the data to work with these systems. And then you have somebody in some random part of the commercial organization is like, well, I'm just going to partner with this consulting firm. They're going to come in and do it. So now we paid for that. And you just have to whack-a-mole those projects so that you can say, no, we're going to take those resources, tap you into this, make sure it fulfills what you need to get out of it. But in some ways, this, if you've seen sort of these technological innovations over time, this one's bigger than anything we've seen before. This is sort of this learning phase that you go through, and eventually we'll get out on the other side of it. But the most important thing we can do right now is we're going to end up spending more than we need to. But let's figure out how we can utilize this technology to the betterment of what we do as an organization. And if I may, I'll give you one example just from this morning. So we have a study ongoing with one of our products where when we move from phase one to phase two, we started to get some sort of funky safety signals, sufficiently so that it probably would kill the drug eventually. So what we did, fortunately, is we curated a lot of the data. We're a leader in this space. We built some AI tools to operate on it and continue to inform us. And within about 3 weeks, we were able to identify a small change in manufacturing that had been made on a process between phase one and phase two. And now we think that we've zeroed in on what the issue is. We can undo that and continue to get this study up and running. We could never have done that 2 or 3 years ago. And so fortunately, that was one of those bottoms-up projects that somebody said, you've got all this data, why don't we curate it in such a way we can do something with it? That's the brilliance of this stuff. Yeah. And we just need to find more of those and invest in those at scale.
No, and I think the fun part now, and I spend most of my days with health system CEOs. So they're similar organization size, maybe have been around for as long. And, you know, you get a range of perspectives of how much time and attention they should spend on AI. You seem like you're on one end of the spectrum. This is a focus. This is an area you're spending time. But, you know, I've heard things from them of AI is everywhere now, but the bottom line.
Well, that's a little bit what these investors are trying.
No, and it's pushing. It's funny because it's true, right? Yeah. You know, these balances. But then you hear stories like the one you mentioned. And so one of my questions is, like, how do you start to create this structure to measure that, right? Amazing use case. Do you get to count the whole drug, right, as the potential? You know, how do you start to document these wins? Because, again, the stories are so powerful at this stage. Yeah. At this stage of learning, why are we spending the money? We're going to spend, as a country, ahead, right, of the impact so far with AI. But then we have to have the stories to kind of keep fueling the fire and to kind of keep attention and interest. And so how have you started to work with your teams to measure, right, an example like this? How do you get to quantify that?
Well, you know, we have a person and who's now building a team where all they will do is begin to figure out how do we, A, track what we're spending, because of how we set this up, it's hard to know where all of these dollars are going. Actually using AI to help us do that, by the way. So one, where are we spending? Two, begin to, you know, say, okay, for the small investments, we're probably never going to ask for an ROI. It just doesn't make sense. You'll spend more time tracking it down than you will actually getting anything useful.
Well, and you can chalk that up to almost like investing in the literacy of the folks that are,
exactly,
right? Yeah.
So, but for the bigger projects, it is now, there's an organizational effort at my level to begin to say, for these, we've got to start coming up with, okay, how are we going to account for the impact that we've seen? You know, on our last earnings call, we said we're going to get a 30% reduction in drug development, the longest period of time and the most money that we spend in getting a new medicine to market. We're going to reduce that time from the first in human to an approval by 30% using these tools. It took us months to figure out that we could actually pull that off, because you're piecing together different pieces of drug development saying, how is AI going to actually cut down on time? So it's just going to be brute force until you systematize it. You get some common language about how you think about the investment you're making. You know, how do you, every time you run one of these models, you're generating energy costs and all of that. So how do you factor that in? So it's not straightforward.
I mean, do you look at the economics? Because those are changing almost as fast as the technology is getting better. Like, you see some of these graphs where, like, the quote-unquote intelligence, however you want to measure, we can argue about the benchmarks, but they are getting better. We know that. And then there's the same almost asymptotic decreasing cost curve per token, for example, yeah, if that's the unit of measure for now. Like, so, like, if you're planning a budgetary cycle of, you know, a logarithmically decreasing you know, expenditure? Like, do you just say, I'm willing to take the bet that this is going to be cheaper and sustainable in terms of a long-term budget planning cycle? Like, in other words, like, it's going to cost X today, but probably maybe an order of magnitude less next year? I mean, is that
that's the logic. Yeah. The logic is we're going to spend more now to ultimately spend less.
Yeah.
And in order to justify that, what we've had to say is, you know what, we're going to begin to pull down costs in other areas to say, I've got a slush fund in which I can use in order to fund this. And the other thing that we're doing to accelerate, because you want to move from the phase where you're just assuming you're going to get benefit to actually yielding benefit, what you start to do is saying, okay, you know what, let's put money where our vision is. Mm-hmm. And say, if I've got an organization where I think I can reduce the costs associated with running that organization using this technology, let's start taking resources out of that group that will accelerate their execution and implementation of this, and then find somebody in the organization who's a visionary who can continue to push it. And then just stay on top of whether or not it's working or not. You may have to dial back a little bit here and there. But ultimately, we're still at the phase where it's like, we're going to invest, and eventually we're going to get a return, and we're going to do everything we can to start tracking where that return's coming from and shift resources accordingly.
What has surprised you as you started this process? And then, like, and how much of your time, right? Obviously, your time is pressed for 1,000 different things, but what has surprised you in this, and how much of your time is focused on, like, the change management of an organization towards investment, allocation, and use of AI?
Well, I think what surprised me is, we've talked about it earlier, just the pace at which it's moving. Like, you guys can't write a curriculum for a class because it's outdated the moment you type it up. Yeah, exactly. But in our case, the speed with which this is having an impact, everyone says this is going to be the space where AI is going to have the biggest impact from a sector standpoint. And you can see that's going to be the case. So that surprised me the most. And you know what's sort of funny is that we're finding it's being used everywhere. And even, you know, we do earnings calls every quarter. And I was like, you know, I really wish I knew what people were going to ask me. Well, as it turns out, somebody heard me ask that question. And they're like, well, let's build a model on every analyst who covers
those analysts ask the same questions in the same industries,
exactly.
Right?
Totally.
That's an amazing use. And
then I said, okay, well, is it accurate? We can predict with about 80% accuracy the questions we're going to get. So it's like having the exam before you take it. So then you're like, all right, well, now I used to get a 500-page binder that I would read diligently the first 200 pages and then hope I wouldn't get a question for the other 300 pages, because you just run out of time. You can't get through all of it. And so they're like, well, why don't we create a tool that you can just say, I want to know everything about this topic, and then put it in my language. So now I've got a tool that scripts my answers to these questions, trudging through all of the resources that we have. Here's where it might go is on the actual call. We're now training a model to listen to the question, because you have kind of what your sort of stock answer will be to that. But at some point, I'd like to be able to say, okay, did I miss anything? And so as the call is taking place and the questions come in, I can look at my computer and say, okay, did I answer the question as thoroughly as I could have? Mm-hmm. And that's just something that occurred because I asked a question. Like, there wasn't a big project around it. Yeah. That's happening everywhere. Yeah. And I think we should let those things go, because eventually you're going to find the idea that helps us accelerate a new asset, enable us to get it to a patient faster. I mean, at the end of the day, where this technology needs to get to is changing human health outcomes. Yeah. And that's going to mean we're going to have to partner with health systems. We're going to have to partner with other parts of the healthcare system, because that's what we're in the business of doing, and I think this technology can be transformative. We haven't even begun to go there yet.
Yeah. Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us. Chris Boehner, the CEO of Bristol Myers Squibb.
Great to be here.
Kimberly Powell from NVIDIA, the Vice President of Healthcare. Thanks so much for joining us again, coming back. Before we talked about robotics, AI and drug discovery, we're definitely going to talk some about agents. But we were just talking about on-prem.
Yeah.
Right, where there's a lot of security concerns today, broadly now with AI, with Mythos, new models coming. Healthcare, obviously one of the most sensitive places for data. And so talk more about what's your vision of like on-prem, cloud, how do you see it at NVIDIA? What questions are health systems going to be talking about?
All right, I think, the agentic world, we're fully in this future now, and that is without a doubt. But if you think about how you're going to be interacting with agents, you're going to want a hybrid approach, no matter who you are, for a lot of reasons. And so edge computing has all of a sudden gotten sexy again, for a lot of good reasons. We were talking in there about lab equipment and how do we make every scientific instrument a robot on day one is by having a little computer that runs an agent and can, listen to all the metadata that's coming off the instrument, can look at, what the experiment's running, see if anything's going off course, correct it. Right then and there, you see where you have a real-time, tight, closed loop that is going to benefit any kind of an instrument, okay? So that's one. Another reason is, there's a lot of people, myself included. I'm an electrical and computer engineer, but I'm not somebody who lives in Linux or other operating systems. I usually live in Windows. A lot of doctors, nurses live in Windows environments because that's what's been largely deemed kind of the de facto enterprise computing across the entire healthcare system. And so wouldn't it be great if they can now also have localized agents just to help them get through their day-to-day and it can run in Windows, an environment that they understand? So I think that's another huge one. Then there's, let's think about cost here a little bit, containing cost. There's a great reason why a lot of, let's go for Eli Lilly announced their AI factory last year. They want to make sure that their scientists have access to what is now, I think, without any dispute, an AI factory is the modern scientific instrument, and they want every single scientist to have as much of that as they can get. And so they're going to deploy that locally. You're also, every single one of them, I almost think about it as an inverted triangle where you're going to have sort of the generalist cloud AI APIs that know everything about generalist knowledge. As soon as you start to get into a domain specific, you're going to start wanting to build your own agents for the work you do. It's more specialized. And then when you get into the core IP of any company, or maybe very core to your patients and your population, you're going to be really wanting to lock down and own that. And so you kind of want to have this tiered approach. And so you can go cloud, you can go cloud on-prem, you can go on-prem to on-desk. And you want to have sort of that ability to go between the three.
I mean, I love that vision because like what we tended to see for a while, especially in healthcare use cases, like, okay, you're constantly testing the cloud models against some benchmark. They're obviously incredibly powerful for lots of use cases. But the question always comes up is, do I need to use the most advanced cloud-based giant model for everything that I want to accomplish? And the answer is obviously no. And then it's like, well, what's the best way to start to think about the open source models? Well, there's an option to run these on-prem. And I think that's a lot of the work that you all have been doing is let's keep an open platform to allow people to customize without having to get into additional services and cloud-based, charges or token costs. But I think at some level, like, what do you think about like the proprietary data aspect? Because I feel like there's a commoditization impact of just the broader data that I think that we're all building models with. But then places like Eli Lilly, certainly healthcare, we have really interesting proprietary unique data. Are you seeing like in combination with agents be able to leverage the data, but actually training? Is there any training going on, I suppose?
Absolutely, yeah, and I appreciate that question. I mean, this is why NVIDIA has really put forward our open source strategy. And we talk about the concept of open models. Open models, I want to define it as it's not just a model. open models is really a set of models for all different domains, whether it's world models with our Cosmos, our multimodal large language models with Nemotron, our biology language models with BioNeMo. It's a collection of models that are at the frontier. They are not the frontier, almost by design, but they're at the frontier, and they're meant to be post-trained with domain-specific data. And for all the reasons that you just described, it's proprietary data, it's you got to protect the data. And frankly speaking, this is the set of that middle tier of sub-agents that is really codifying your domain expertise, right? This is your craft. This is your deep domain specialty. And so you have to do post-training, or you have to do reinforcement learning so you can align these models to the task or the job that it's trying to get done. And so we really need a huge collection of open models. And we literally try to partner across the ecosystem, whether it's the, you know, the EVO models that's coming out of the ARC Institute, or, you know, the OpenFold models that, you know, for all the protein fold, that's in the biology realm, but even all over the language models, we're working on this. So I think it's really important that people learn that AI is not just a model. And actually, it's a lot more than even the open models that I'm describing. But the open models I'm describing give you the opportunity to really exercise and create these domain-specific models. And then, as you know, we're going way beyond the model. We're going into these agentic systems. So you do need to have levels of reasoning. And so both Cosmos and Nemotron had big announcements last week. You know, they are multimodal. They reason, right? You need them to be able to reason with you. And what they're also able to do then is with this reasoning capability in agentic, you're going to go have the agent do work. And what do you need to do work? You need to go tap into a knowledge base to understand something about a subject matter. You need to go use a tool that you might have used way in the background. That tool could be an electronic health record system. Or you need to create a skill that is, you know, every time that I'm with my patient and we say, we need to get you an MRI, you actually go deploy a skill that says, let me go check, you know, the next nearest MRI appointment that might be available to my patient, right? You can see how knowledge and tools and skills are now surrounding the model. And so that's what they call like these agent harnesses. And then the application developer really specifies the orchestration of this, right? It's like, I know how my hospital works. And so I'm going to specify the orchestration of this. And then I need to give it access to the knowledge, to the tools, and to the skills. And so we want to make sure all of that's available. And again, you want that to maybe run in a lab, in the doctor's office, or on the cloud and have choice.
Yeah, I know. And just going back to what you started with, which is like there was a bit of a, to get on-prem in a health, 95% of healthcare globally is on a Windows operating system. It's wild, right? It's a stat that not a lot of people think about. And as you think about the hardware shift, to your point, these capabilities are going to come together with a platform that can run this seamlessly. And I think it's going to start to accelerate a lot more than what we're seeing today, which again has that slight sort of mild barrier to get to the cloud. Is everyone, you know, does everyone have the right budget or the right team to really leverage all this on the cloud? And to your point, this inverted triangle, I like the way you think about that. I think that's really exactly coming from hardware all the way up to the largest models. Yeah.
But I guess where, so again, we're here because we all live this every day. What's happening in the future? What's coming? What is the constraint in your mind? Like, what is the constraint stopping a health system from like really being able to achieve this? Like, what will just unlock the field to run? Because we're still not there yet. We don't fully see it yet today. So what is the constraint in your mind?
Yeah, I guess I have maybe two that come to mind. I mean, to your point of people's definition of what AI is still evolving. And just as you said, the magic is going to happen. And it happened with me, right? As a non-developer, right? A lot of the current AI we're living in is coding agents that are just amazing at that craft. Well, imagine you put this on in the hands of any doctor or healthcare professional in general, and what might come to mind of what problems they might want to solve. But they need to be able to know that they have access to do that. And that still is going to take some time, which is, you know, I love how Jensen said, we just reinvented the PC for the first time in 40 years. Mm. That reinvention, to put it into the hands of thoughtful professionals from any domain, is going to blow the use cases open. Right. I mean, it's magical what it did for coding, and it's a necessary condition. But now you can just think about solving almost anything. But they need to be empowered to do so. They need to have the right infrastructure, which could be this agent PC. They need to have, you know, the ability to now, you know, access some of their data, but do it the way they do it on-prem now. It should be all within the firewall. And we've now just literally in the last 48 hours kind of unlocked that potential condition to do everything in your firewall on your PC and start to, you know, give the capabilities that, you know, high-tech companies have been throwing a lot of muscle at where that doesn't always exist into some of these industries. So I think that understanding, we've got to really accelerate that. And now we have the infrastructure that's coming out to say that's no longer a problem. Now it's going to be more about education and making sure that you do all the right things from an IT perspective that are necessary. And then when we're talking about the open models front, you know, things like that, you know, data is still a challenge. You can talk to any pharmaceutical company here. You can talk to any healthcare system. We're still not AI data ready. And so there's a lot of potential. You know, there's great companies like Snowflake and Databricks who are really trying to help enterprises get their data into a place that it can be operated on, because agents are useless without data, right? That knowledge base, and or the other amazing thing about agents is they're always running. So they should be able to pick up and sense this bit that changed over here, and it should alert you that something's going wrong. And that statement I just said, imagine having that always on patient monitoring system in your environment. It's going to be huge. And therefore, you're moving away from you're prompting the computer to it's prompting you. But that data unlock, or, you know, at least organizing the data, getting it data ready, getting it agent friendly, and every sort of domain situation has its own challenges. I mean, right, we work with companies like Tetra Science, who are trying to take all lab data and get it into an ontology that can be used for scientific workflows. It's a scientific data platform, right? And so we've got to really, you know, we work a lot with those partners as well. And we're saying, again, here, how can we bring the compute closer to the data so you can work really fast? Because, the challenge now is you have to move at the speed of thought. Right, you have your next idea, you want to go. And the whole point is iterate, turn.
If you have the data.
If you have the
and
data.
And you have the knowledge to know we're doing that.
But we just finished, so we just as an example, we just finished our course at Stanford. We teach every you know, quarter course on generative AI in healthcare. And this is the first time we've done this, to your point about the domain experts having ideas and being able to act on that, right, with some of the coding models. We asked them to build a solution, and there was a little bit of resistance initially.
There was a lot of resistance,
right? They were like, "I don't know how to code. Like, are you crazy? Like, you know?" And we're like, "No, just trust us that once you get past that initial barrier, and you saw the light bulb switch on with folks from across the health system, certainly in the business school that were in our class, and I think that's the final unlock. I think there's the capabilities are starting to come into focus. And it's bringing that domain expert, getting their head around that they can now build things that solve problems for them in their specific domain without needing to have, you know, again, a full product lifecycle, whatever else, to accomplish something. It's amazing. It's an amazing time.
It really is. It's an amazing time.
And I think one of the interesting things, I spend all my time with health systems. How do we unlock this? How do we move faster? The data infrastructure is almost probably the worst in healthcare of any large enterprise industry, where there's huge migrations still to do, many different reasons for this, many different silos. But getting them now, and now people are starting to really engage on, we have to get that at a place where we can unlock and use it. And then the other thing I find so interesting is many people are saying, well, hey, and in general for healthcare, it's, why don't we just wait? Let's just wait. We'll wait for the next model. Let's wait for someone else to prove it. It will get better. And like, it's true. Like, of course, this interesting part you mentioned, though, is like people. And this is where I find myself spending time. And I'm curious how you do this, which is people aren't going to shift overnight.
like this, right? And healthcare is one, the largest employer in most states, right? And how do we start training our people? Because that you can wait to deploy a model, in a year, but you can't wait to start training your people. And so I'm curious how you all are engaging, how we need to kind of get out the word for healthcare. It's part of the reason we agreed to this and in trying to do this, but like, what are you seeing? What are different ways where you're engaging people to kind of really get to engage? When healthcare typically keeps a pretty arm's length approach to new technology.
Well, I guess I'll make an observation. And first of all, it was Menlo Ventures' observation in data that said healthcare systems are deploying enterprise AI 3 times faster than the economy. This is the first time in history. That tells you what's going on here. And you look at what companies are driving that. Those are companies like Abridge and Ambient Voice Technologies. Why? Because they're solving an absolute, acute, catastrophic problem in the healthcare system here in the United States, but it's a global phenomenon. And they've solved it in such a way, there's zero barrier to entry. It's, may I record this conversation on this phone? Click, the agent system gets to work. Okay, they now get 30% or more of their time back, and work is being done in the background that they are still completely in the loop on, and they get to do the final exquisite work and check off on everything. So the other company that comes to mind is Open Evidence. Having the world's most up-to-date, richest medical knowledge in your pocket that is so exquisitely designed that it can read and think and communicate with you like you were trained as a physician. It can go through the papers and present you the data in just the right form factor that you would want it. It's really hard to read these papers.
Especially overnight call shifts and, yes, all the other things going on.
And then imagine this amazing capability they unlocked earlier this year is, as you're having this conversation about a particular patient, they might see that there's some inclusion-exclusion criteria in there to connect you with a clinical trial that is so hard to do today and is such a slowdown of patients getting access as well as drug companies making progress in clinical development. And so if I just use those two examples, they're so well made, so easy to use, that now the healthcare professionals can't live without it. So I would say, how does that come back to education? They need to use it. They just need to engage it. They don't have to build it at the get-go. But the faster you or somebody else in that health system could make something for them to just start using it, it will build trust. It will build the feeling like, I can't believe I didn't have this before. And how would I, if you took this away,
That's how you know, right? If you take it away, I'm going to have a way worse work-life balance or way worse work experience.
Step number one is just engage it and use it. Yeah. And then step number two is, how do we get you to be somebody who could be a builder of it, right? These are all highly trained medical professionals who've dedicated their life to this. You know, they have a craft. You can, just like you and I, and the way that I want to get my daily calendar looks different than the way you want. I mean, on the simplest form, but so I get to go train it the way I want it. Yeah. And that's empowering. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. And so that's kind of the next phase of it. Right. And so I think, but just the first is just to touch and use it.
Yeah. And one of the things I'll mention just about the adoption, I think that the interesting thing about both those solutions you brought up, massively popular. And you don't, at least I don't immediately think AI. I think just solving, it's a problem that I'm thinking it's solving. And that, I think, is a huge shift that when you know it's working and you know it's well adopted, you don't call it AI anymore. You just call it, this is my solution for notes. Yeah. This is my solution for evidence that I need to take care of my patient. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, it's kind of an interesting.
Because you're not calling it, when you call it AI, it just feels like a piece of tech or a tool. When you're saying, let me show you how I can make your life better every single day.
Totally.
Like, who wouldn't listen to that? Yeah. Who wouldn't want to engage that? And then measuring it, I think, is a really important thing, right? It's when you go into these like trial periods or whatever, or just users, like really learn how they're using it and what benefit they're getting out of it, because the fact of the matter is these things are very easy to customize and evolve. And so if it's just missing on this one thing, don't let that kill it. Yeah. Say, oh, give me a second. We'll go fix it. Right?
Yeah, you don't have to wait 2 years for that feature to get shipped. Like it will be there.
Installment, 3 years of learning how to use it. You know, yeah, it's not. It's just kind of over there update. It can be fixed just by a prompt.
Yeah. It's this very different, which again is a new muscle. It's a new way for people to adopt. It's a new way for people to expect change. And then the building part you mentioned is fascinating. And so I'm curious, when is that, you know, we could pick a number, we could pick a way to describe it, but like when are 20% of people in healthcare? Prediction, both of you. So Matt actually, well, Matt McElroy, when are 20% of people in healthcare going to be building and customizing their own agents, not just the adopter, like it'd be a documentation. Well, what's your timeline?
If you count like the things that you kind of talked about, just small customizations, like I like to have my OR schedule at this particular, like all the, you know, every physician has their own list of things that they like their way. I would say it's within the next 2 years. I think the tools are being deployed at a scale that I haven't seen before. I mean, you do this like with Qualify, but your answer too.
Adoption is different at different institutions. When there is a CEO and C-suite top-down mandate that we're taking a direction, that this AI, again, AI isn't an innovation. This is a transformation and a direction that we're going, and we all are expected, and they even are talking about the different automations that they're doing. And again, in healthcare, I like to use the word automation because agents, AI, it gets people in a different thinking. So like, hey, this things you do multiple times a day, how can you automate that?
If you do something three times a day, that's pretty straightforward. Why not automate it?
Yeah, correct. Yeah. And so there we're starting to see, you know, cases where you have 20% of an institution kind of using AI and customizing to some level. And you have other institutions where AI is a pilot project on the side of a small team. And so there's just huge differences. Yeah. But I think at particular institutions, you'll see that 20% number, like you're seeing it this year.
Okay.
I love it.
Are you saying this year too, or what are you?
I'm in for it. If I'm any, you know, testament of like, you know, doing it myself, because it's really intriguing, and it can be very, to your point of automation, it can be very powerful to free my mind. I mean, this is what we want. We want every healthcare professional operating at the top of their license.
Sure.
Automation is the way to get it there. Mm-hmm. And so if they could, if everyone just could believe in that, because I believe it's true. I think it will go very fast. And they, you know, every medical professional touches a computer today. They all have to touch a mouse and a keyboard, you know, and there's just so much that, you know, we could put in their hands to empower them to do their amazing work. So I'm excited. This year. Let's do it.
This year. In certain cases.
Now you're hedging. No.
No, I said certain cases. I absolutely do not mean globally.
Well, thank you so much for being here with us. Again, you're our first official second guest on the pod, and we're just hope we have you back soon.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to. It's good to see you guys.
Nice to see you.
Thanks.
As someone who's gotten a reveal on data that's been positive where I've had the honor to present, you're just at a moment, you remember that moment when you're sitting in front of the computer or sitting in the meeting and the company or the agency shows you that survival curve and you're like, you know, it's that moment.
And you think about all the people you've treated and all, like, you just, yeah.
But then you gotta pivot.
Yeah.
Okay. How are we going to prove this?
Yeah.
Where else does it go?
Yeah.
Please let's get it out there. You know, so.
Where do you see... Where are things going to change, right? You know, I think, you know, we've talked about, again, that survival curve, science, that has been true for decades now in medicine, and we've seen amazing advances. You know, we're here, right, Stanford Health AI Week, talking about, you know, a particular topic, but where do you think changes are going to happen? Where do you see that, you know, whether in trials, as we were talking about, or how you're delivering or doing research, what do you think is coming?
You know, one of the initiatives I started at City of Hope was an integrative oncology program. And the reason I did that is because, number one, we can't ignore what Eastern medicine brings. And we seem to accept things that we seem are traditional scientific. Oh, that's a chemotherapy and it's a traditional compound. But there are plenty of vitamin A and other derivatives. I mean, these have been around for long-standing times. Paclitaxel came from a bark and a plant. And so we accept certain things and we reject certain things. And I believe you have to think open mind and think of the entire patient experience. So that is from worried about cancer to surviving to longevity. I think we have to put the same focus on the provider side. We have a nursing shortage. We're going to have an oncology shortage. I have faculty that are burning out because they're typing on a computer all day. And so I think there is an excitement around what AI could bring in a meaningful, tangible, measurable way to start creating efficiencies. And I can't wait for that. Equally important on the front side, where if we can accelerate accruals to clinical trials, help people find them earlier, not as a last-ditch effort. We know that the regional and community-based practices don't have access to as many trials as academic centers. And 80% of our population is not getting that out of the gates. These are the things that I'm excited about and I feel can absolutely happen in the next 5 to 10 years based on the platforms that are being built, quantum computing that can come up. I mean, we have a server shortage right now, and we need to build people. I don't think I understand how much power and cost it is.
You could turn City of Hope into data centers. That's another.
Well, we have lots of land in both campuses, 122 acres in Duarte and 65 in Orange County.
Allbirds did it to you guys. Yeah.
That's right. So these are the things that I think are rate-limiting steps, but can absolutely accelerate the science, accelerate the patient experience, and preserve our workforce.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think a lot of people... Let's rewind the clock. I think with AlphaFold, some of the traditional protein and the impossible problems, and we saw the breakthrough, obviously, you know, Nobel Prize, it was major achievement. And I think one of the questions that was asked is, besides just the general impatience for when is this going to start changing, you know, how quickly we get new drugs in the market, but even ignoring that, I think it's opened the aperture for what are all the problems and opportunities along the way from drug development, target identification, all the way to a survival curve. And I think to your point, you're kind of seeing it across the spectrum from where you sit. And you pointed out a couple big things. I think one was, do I even know about the trial? Because there's so many. Do I even know that this patient's eligible? That's just an information problem at some level, right? And then there's, can I select them and refer them? And then to your point about the holistic care, are there other... Is there evidence I don't read in different journals that also may help? So, like, I feel like you're pointing out that there's this kind of arc of information that we're starting to get our hands around in ways we haven't before. Is that kind of how you're seeing it?
Yeah, if you just look at different segments, I mean, how many drugs have been sitting on the shelf in different companies, different warehouses that may actually confer activity now that the science has caught up, at least to a certain degree? And the exciting part is we're learning more about each individualized person as their own experiment, N of one, as opposed to grouping you in with a bunch of folks. Can we decipher back in clinical trials that were negative? But I guarantee you, every time I tell somebody the benefit of being in a clinical trial is that there's always a few people, depending on the size, who actually benefit. It just didn't get the number that needed to produce a statistical p-value. So can we actually find those people, their characteristics, their data, apply some of these drugs that have deemed to be not so successful or marginally successful or proof or under indications and bring them back into the fold? This is where you could just see the multiplier occur.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is achievable? You talked about clinical trial recruitment. You know, this... has been a problem forever. You know, you talked about new targets, new folding, et cetera. Most of the cost happens later.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
On trial recruitment. What is achievable? You know, you mentioned 5-10 years. What do you think is achievable in the next 2 years? How many more patients can we get on trials? How much easier can it get? You know, because there's always this
technological capability, but then like adoption across healthcare. So you sit at that intersection. What do you think is achievable?
Well, I tell you, I took over the system clinical trial job at City of Hope about two and a half years ago. So I can give you that window. Mm-hmm. I had to restructure it. We're a system that's not just a campus model. And you should never think you're just a campus model because that ignores the surrounding community. Mm-hmm. We built our new campus in Irvine. We acquired campuses in North Chicago, Atlanta, and Phoenix. This gives us 40 sites across four states. Now, how are you going to maximize that? I restructured the office. No AI here. This is just brute strength. That's right. Old school. That's right. Pull up the sleeves. And I told people, we're building superhighways. Now, you got to drive the car. But we're going to make sure those lanes are open. Maybe there's express lanes that are open. And our enrollment numbers have been beating record after record. We crossed 1,400 interventional treatment accruals last year. We're going to cross over 1,550 this year. A single month in our system, the high was 156 patients in 1 month accrued in January. That was until we hit April and had 171. And that's just interventional treatment. That's with a therapeutic. We're enrolling hundreds of more in the non-therapeutic and other realms. So that's just brute strength. Yeah. Now you add technology to create efficiencies, to empower the local physicians to drive efficiency with time so they don't have to hunt and they don't have to look. As a specialist, I know what trials are open in lung cancer. I always did. And my first five patients in my clinic are lung cancer, lung cancer, lung cancer, lung cancer. When you're in a community practice, your first five patients are lymphoma, head and neck cancer, breast cancer. That's already covering 300 trials. You're not even going to start.
Yeah.
Because then you'll delay things. Your patient satisfaction, Press Ganey scores will go down. You'll get dinged by your system. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So this is where I see opportunity. Empower those frontline providers who are where the patients are. Meet them there and literally put the tools in their hands to empower this. The companies, if you shaved 2 months off of enrollment, what is that a cost of at net present value? If you improve it by another month after that, this, we're talking things. I would have loved to have seen this data from pancreatic cancer last year at ASCO, because then it would have meant the trial accrued faster. 1 year of people that could have taken this drug who die so quickly from pancreatic cancer. Think of the lives saved and the lives benefited. This is how we have to how to measure it.
Yeah. Do you think that the way that you're setting up the infrastructure, my guess is you're also layering on top of that the data and sort of AI connectivity piece. Like, is there a world where centers like yours are able to start kind of tapping on the glass of that we've been talking about forever, which is this digital twin concept, where do I need to have a placebo arm or not? Because it just, there's some things you just wonder, is this ethical at some level, right? We know we have to do it for the betterment of the science, but are we almost to a place where the technology is at such that we can actually run a trial with a virtual arm like that?
So, and I'm going to commentary a little bit here. So first, part of the brute strength was, what are the easy things to take hurdles out of the clinician's way? I created a program called Hope Pathways. And what it does is, on three clicks, you can actually see if you have a patient with lung cancer in front of you, exactly the trials that are open and at your site in three clicks. And if the symbol is green, it means it's open. If it's red, it's not open.
And this is simply just information, surfacing information.
Straight from the Encore or whatever your CTMS is, straight in there. So study coordinator changes the field, it changes the color.
Interesting.
It's so visual, it's so quick, you didn't waste any time. And you can see right away. Now, if there is a trial, you can actually get the information with another click, and with one click, send an inquiry to a centralized study coordinator who will answer you within 24 hours and start looking at the eligibility. Simple. Keep it simple. Make it easy. So that was a way we empowered our frontline folks. To answer your question about digital twins, again, I always like to lean in front of the patient. And we know that there's benefit in some drugs, but maybe not enough. As someone who actually chaired the central IRB for the NCI for over 5 years, I understand patient safety. I understand these things. I feel like we are too cautious in our drug approvals. Think of the number of drugs we've actually, over time, and indications that we've actually had to pull back. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's enough. Okay? If you're a 300 hitter in baseball, you're an all-star. You're a Hall of Famer. I'm not saying we should use 300 as our level, but it certainly shouldn't be 99%. I think there are people benefiting out there. You want to make sure it's safe. But as long as you're doing no harm, I think it's okay. So that's my informal commentary of if we can speed up the process, speed up the reviews, and have a bar to let people try these drugs out there. Yeah. You might learn actually that some are more effective than they're not or others.
This is the really interesting thing. Actually, we had Amy Abernathy mm-hmm. on before mm-hmm. where she was at the FDA in different roles on the data side. And as we have better, and again, this is another AI part separate from drug discovery, post-deployment monitoring, we can lower the bar if we get to a safety threshold to get things out in the wild. And then if we actually set up as an infrastructure, and this is bigger than any system, but a system can do it at an individual level and then start to scale this out, then you can actually move a lot faster to take things off that you don't see, right? You know, what is the rate that we should be doing that? Again, arguably lower than 99% as just how much that would increase the throughput of what we would get to see. And the tools make that ever more capable today, yeah. right? The information retrieval that we can get in structured and unstructured imaging to actually be able to monitor for this is at a completely different level with the tools. And so I love that. I love that vision.
And to answer your question about control arms, placebo arms, digital twins, look, the drugs we had in the past, you had to have very strict eligibility criteria because the benefits were measured in days, right. weeks, or months. Yeah. Small number of months. Yeah. It was a 2-month improvement in lung cancer for the longest time to get that 0.8 hazard ratio. Yeah. We don't want those drugs anymore.
Yeah,
we don't want them. So my push, and we've worked with ASCO and Friends of Cancer Research, with the FDA, Rick Pazder, with the NCI, with CTEP, is to expand eligibility criteria. Yeah. Why are we excluding people for non-scientific reasons into clinical trials? They want to join. They can't because we are unnecessarily doing it. And that will prevent this exclusion. I think we can absolutely use historical standards. And we're biasing against rare cancers and rare diseases by setting up these models. How are you going to run a placebo-controlled arm with a incidence of a biomarker of 0.1% with effective therapies? Right. And yes, everybody's punting to early stage now, so they're running the randomized trials in early stage. But pretty soon, we're going to be like breast cancer. Do we really want to run a 10,000-patient study to prove one aromatase inhibitor might be better than the other by 1% to 2%? I don't think so. I hope we don't go there.
Well, and this kind of goes back to one of the threads that has come up probably since we started this podcast, this conversation with different leaders, is the patient is now empowered in a way that maybe has never happened before. In other words, like, you know, they're going to be looking for that old drug that's now generic that's not being used anymore. They're going to be like asking questions, what possible thing would work for my specific cancer, and they're putting their lab values and they're putting their biopsy results, their genetic, you know, profile of their tumor. And I think that's going to push us, if there's not a concerted effort on our side, to have to make some changes as a system. And I think physicians, as you know, front on the front lines, are looking at cases of compassionate use, which drugs can they possibly, and then we've heard stories of folks going so far as to push the development of mRNA vaccines for individual cancer. And so it does feel like there's a push-pull here. I think there's a willingness on almost all parties to do something, but almost we have a new voice in the room. For the first time, the patients are saying, they're standing up and saying, I'm empowered to take advantage of my own, you know, technology I have available to me and address my healthcare problems.
You know, we have two very important sayings in research at City of Hope. And these are the things that we live that are literally our moonshots, our guiding force, our North Star. One is every patient who comes to us deserves the opportunity to be on a clinical trial. Mm-hmm. That's one. Number two is speed, scale, serve. speed to activation, scale to multiple sites to serve that end user, the patient, to empower that provider. And I welcome the patient dialogue. It's no different than somebody who printed out 100 pages off of AOL, off of their net search. And I'm sure it took them 24 hours to do that search and just to get it loaded. Yeah. And that forces the clinician, the scientist, the researcher to up their game.
Yeah, that's right.
You got to be on top of that. Mm-hmm. That's what competition builds. And we thrive on that. So whether it's academic centers against each other, scientists against each other, or the patients and their advocates and their the people who are rallying around them to find every piece of information possible, I welcome that. I think that is great, and it's such an important voice in this whole conversation.
100%. Yeah.
So I want to come back to, you've mentioned so many interesting things, so many interesting improvements. What is the constraint? What is the constraint holding us back from that vision that's possible? You've mentioned so many different ones, but like, if what is the one that if we removed, we would just be in a different place?
Well, I view it as and it's kind of the same thing. It's a resource constraint. It's whether it's the person's time who's helping develop these tools, whether it's the resources accessible to them. You've heard about great tools, but we need structured data. Now, how deep do we go back to fix all the data flaws that we've had? Because the worst thing we can do is to rush it and have a biased decision making. That is, we cannot have that situation. You will lose the trust, it will all fall through. So it is, what is the problem to be solved? How deep or backwards do you go to solve it versus just going prospective? And who has the time and the resource to put in? And I'm glad we have partnerships with industry. I'm glad we have our partnerships with technology companies who are doing this. Before, the limiting fact was the semiconductor and the microchip. That's changed. Now it's going to be water and power and resources. But I view a really exciting chapter coming up for people with all types of chronic diseases and health ailments to be able to benefit from this technology. And I think we all sense it. Getting biomarkers in cancer was such a pipe dream in 2000. Yeah. In 2004, we reported two papers that had a total of 14 patients on there that defined EGFR mutations. But it wasn't until 2012 that it actually became publicly utilized into the patient. We need to shrink those timelines down, and it's happening, which is exciting. It's moving so fast that experts are now becoming dinosaurs like myself. So, you know, it's okay. We need new smart people to come in and do this.
Well, I think to add to that too, and one of the last things I'll say as we wrap, I think, you know, the technologic curve is exponential. I think a lot of us could agree with that. But it if you just pause for a sec, just in terms of looking back, imagine that you can put in all of the information about the genetic mutations in a large, you know, readout that you would have had to shop around or wait months to find someone. Do you know what this means? Like, what, you know, and the fact that a model that's on your phone can start to answer, it's just wild to me. And what that, you know, what that ultimately means to me is that the barriers to understanding your disease and the conversations you can have with your expert physicians is just, it's dissolving, and it's just such an incredible time.
But context is so important, as we talked about in the sessions. If you do genetic testing on yourself and your family and you get some results and you don't know what they mean and you're just reading the footnotes, it's going to be a long Christmas vacation before you can get in front of a genetic counselor. So that's, it's right, really important to have the context of the expertise behind it. And that's what I warn people.
Let alone the full body MRI. We're in Silicon Valley up here,
we're
a little bit north
of
you.
Programs this fall, but we're putting the right people together so that nobody gets results until we go over it with them. So
we could talk for hours. I'm sure about that. Ed Kim, physician in chief at City of Hope. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you
so much. Yeah.
What I see is we're living in a time of unbounded potential. AI is part of it, but there's so much more. You all know how much is happening with biology. There's so much potential. And yet our country is in this crisis. And one of the consequences of the polarization and all, you know, all of the mess that we're in is we're not only are we not seizing these huge opportunities, but we're destroying our basic capacity for R&D.
I have to say, we've done what, like 15, 20 shows over the last year and a half with leaders from across, I mean, literally tech, medicine, life sciences, even government. That has not come up, and I'm surprised, actually. So, the idea about the funding of, like, I feel like it's always been, as an American, something that I could count on, that the NIH, the NSF, the CDC, they're just bedrock institutions that I know if it comes from that, I don't have to, like, double check it or think twice about it. Do you know what I mean? And, like, and you're kind of maybe suggesting that that has started to shift. And so tell us more about that, because I think that's very unnerving to hear as clinician, someone who, you know, believes in science, you know, was funded by those institutions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're living in a time in which so many of the things we all took for granted for all, you know, all the years of our professional lives, you can't take for granted. And the ones you just talked about, federal research agencies, National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health, but also public health organizations, CDC, FDA. It's the funding that we knew was the bedrock of the innovation system. Everything else builds on top of it. Plus, the trust in those institutions to use scientific facts in making decisions about vaccine recommendations, right? All of that.
Is that kind of, just by the social narrative and whatever, that felt like where we hit a branch point in the road in terms of people's belief, or they always hold that as the point at which they change their point of view, whether it was we should believe in it more and or we don't believe in anything, we're kind of nihilists about science. And did it go back further than that? Because I actually haven't thought about it that deeply, actually.
Look, if you step back, what's happening in our country is a national crisis that is the result of the polarization that has grown over a very long time, which grew out of, you know, record inequality. For too many people, the American dream became a fiction, which is, you know, a heartbreaking thing to think about. So we're at this very dangerous juncture as a country. What that danger is manifesting in the destruction, the attempted destruction, because I'm not ready to give up, but the attempted destruction of one institution of our democracy after another. Look at the rule of law. Look at people being shot in the streets for exercising their First Amendment rights, the most precious rights we have as American citizens. Horrible things are happening. And many of those things have immediate horrible consequences. The gutting, they haven't managed to gut it yet. The attacks on federally funded research and development have some immediate consequences. There are clinical trials that got stopped in the middle. For sure, researchers' lives have been disrupted. But the real issue there is that for years and decades into the future, there will be fewer drugs to solve critical medical problems. We won't have the national security capabilities that we need. We won't have the next revolutions in technology that create new industries. That's what we are putting at stake. And so it's a much bigger problem than R&D and science and technology. But you know, that's the institution I'm fighting for, because that's the one I think I can do something about.
It almost seems like if I had to write a movie script of like the things that have happened in healthcare and AI and science, and it almost seems like with this kind of threat, this sort of change, this disruption, it's almost like the last minute, you know, AI writ large is coming in at a time when maybe we need it the most. I don't know if that's a weird, maybe I'm too much of a techno-optimist, but in terms of...
You're being a techno-optimist.
I am, but I'm saying like in discovery and like information, we just had a...
It's amazing.
Yeah, right? And so like... Do you have a balanced view in the sense that, like, does AI solve any or help solve any of these
it can.
Threats? Yeah.
I don't think it's going to deal with the threat I am talking about. I think it is a powerful force that, because we're not wrangling it and putting it to good use as a society quite yet, I have great hopes that we will. But when you don't wrangle this disruptive force, I think it actually exacerbates our national crisis right now. I am so blown away by the disconnect between the techno-optimism of Silicon Valley and, you know, the tech sector is just like, they're high on how exciting AI is. And then have you seen the latest polling? The latest Pew poll says that 50% of Americans think that AI will do more harm than good. Only 10% of Americans think that it's going to be a net positive. And those numbers are getting worse, not better. Yes.
How do we fix that? Because again, we're here, right? Yeah. We've been in Silicon Valley. We're optimists. Again, in some ways, you know, some people have called out, DC is more closely aligned with Silicon Valley than usual. And we can say whether that's good or bad in a unique way. But there are incredible, and we're here at Stanford and Health AI Week, we're seeing incredible positive,
the potential
undeniably positive use cases that are starting to happen and come about. And yet this public narrative and the general public opinion is that AI is not a force for good, not a force for them.
Or that much more concern, so, right.
How do we reconcile these things and how do we work to improve this? Because if we don't actually get, whether it's funding, attention, highlighting of the positives, it has been getting worse. So what do we do? What do we do about that?
I don't think it's a marketing problem. I think it's a facts on the ground problem. And number one, I think the first place to start when you think about this generation of AI, a lot of its power is its breadth. And so you're seeing applications in biology and medicine, but of course that's one of 500 areas that it's changing. And if you are, if you work in customer service, and that was the first area where we saw quantifiable, powerful business productivity improvements. Bryn Hofson here at Stanford did the work, showed I think it was a 14% improvement in customer service productivity, controlled experiment, real world situation. So like I read that and I thought, that's a CFO who is very happy today, right? Like a cost center got 14% productivity improvement. My customer service still sucks. I'm very sure they fired people rather than paying them more, right? So I think it's a fact that it's causing problems for people. I don't think it's just, you know, that we haven't explained it. We haven't explained how it works well enough, right? Like that's not the problem. And I think even in medicine, you all know, because you know, the whole game is to use this technology responsibly and really be thoughtful about what you're doing. And if it's done, I think medicine is a place where people care, and also it is actually a pretty heavily regulated, healthcare provision is a pretty regulated area. And so I think there are enough, right? I think it's an area where there are some controls in place so that you can't just willy-nilly, you know, embed bias in an algorithm or rely on an algorithm to make a life and death decision without a human in the loop. So I think it's actually one of the areas where I'm more optimistic. I'd like to see us actually be able to use AI in more healthcare applications, but I think that won't happen until insurers are confident enough to be able to assess risks. So I think there's a lot more work to be done there. But I think it's quite different if you look at labor impacts because of business productivity enhancements in business operations. And it's very different if you look at, you know, when I was at the White House, we spent a lot of time thinking about generative AI and what the risks would be and speculating about which would turn into actual harms. The first place I will tell you it turned into significant harms was deep fake nudes, which just exploded overnight. And, you know, we still haven't really wrangled that problem. So there's a lot more work to be done.
It's really interesting to talk with you about this because, like, it kind of pulls us a little bit out of what we typically focus on, which is literally just AI and healthcare. Thinking about other industries and how that impact, and then trying to pull it back into our world, it's like, so for us, like, in, at least as you know very well, the narrative around the amount of physicians and other well-trained healthcare workers, nurses, others, who are doing administrative work that is not, has nothing to do with their education, their training, the mission that they're, you know, the reason they went into this field, and peeling that back is like a euphoric victory. And then maybe through other industries that is maybe not the same, right? Maybe that chunk of work is my actual entire livelihood. So I can see that tension, but I think that the side that we've found is that, does it unlock the opportunity for doing more or doing different things? It's complicated, right? In healthcare, it's also complicated in our world too, but it sounds like the way you're kind of looking at the broader economy, it's not just the narrative. It's actually literal dollars and cents that are being, I guess, maybe AI is an excuse. Maybe it truly is delivering the ROI. But are you seeing, is that the same kind of juxtaposition you're seeing where like it's not all sunshine and roses to peel back some of these tasks that we would consider, I would love to get them out of my way to do my, to take care of patients, for example. Exactly. Yeah.
You know, every doctor I've seen in the last year or so starts by saying, is it okay to use AI to, and every one of them, I ask them how they like it. And every one of them says how great it is because, you know, it really sucked that they weren't able to look at their patients because they were looking at the computer. So I think that's a great example and it's freeing them to be the doctors and the healthcare providers that they always wanted to be. But I think that, this is why I'm uncomfortable with these sort of broad brush, you know, it will always be like this or it'll always be like that. Because for, you're right, for other people, it's gutting the job that is their livelihood. And I think sorting that out, the great sorting is happening. What's happening is a massive experiment across all sectors of the economy simultaneously. And no one's talking about it as an experiment. Well, the thing I'm seeing companies do that I think doesn't really make sense is, you know, CEOs are exhorting their people to use AI and firing people in anticipation of and blaming AI when I'm not sure that's actually why they're firing people. But I would love to see people be rigorously experimental and actually look to their employees and say, you're the one who does this job. Please spend 20% of your time experimenting and learning and tell us what works and then share it with your colleagues. And you'll get rewarded for that. You'll share in the expansion of what we're able to do as an enterprise. But unfortunately, that's not what I'm really seeing.
I will say some companies here are doing it, and I can know that with a fact because like we are doing that as a CEO of a 100-ish person company now. But it's hard, right? And it's hard. We spent a couple days last week on we are going to dedicate time to a hackathon to learn and build internal tooling to make things better. It comes down from weekly, we need to be sharing and learning and training each other on these tools. And we're fortunate to be in a place where we are growing as a startup. And so like really, truly every job here we can keep and we can expand because we have infinite demand to work with systems. However, all of the jobs are going to change. My job as a CEO is changing. What are the things I can automate to make myself better, to replace what I was doing so that I can do more? And however, there's just like very different narratives. And so I think I bring that up as an example because this is a little bit one of the reasons I see this kind of disconnect between Silicon Valley and people spending so much of our time, right, focused on these tools and what's happening, what's possible, versus the general narrative is not that, is loss of job, work, productivity. And that's happening with some companies in the Valley as well, where cultures have been destroyed. And it's just a very interesting time where, to your point, the large experiment, there are people taking opposite positions of how to motivate your workforce, engage your workforce. Hospitals are taking very different positions with these AI tools. We were just talking about the future of research with someone of how, you know, you're able to get people on trials and do things differently.
There's a lot of potential.
But it is interesting, your point of, you know, is it facts on the ground versus marketing? There are good stories to get out. And it is an interesting choice as a country of where and how do we want to focus and where how do we want to shape attention? Because it is, again, it is one of the most important issues, I think, that we have to tackle. And I don't know that anyone knows the right way to do it, but we are facing it no matter what we choose.
Yeah, and I think I love being experimental, and everyone that's taking a different approach is an experiment, and I think we should learn from all of them. That's good.
Do you feel like, so one of the things that, because like, actually this is one of the origin stories of this, the podcast, the format that we do, is that it's changing so quickly. And one of the things that I struggle with, and going back to the idea of fundamental research science, is that like every time I see a, this is my whole thing, every time I see a, I tell my students this too, every time I see a peer review paper that talks about what AI can and cannot do, I immediately go down and look at what model they're using and almost without fail.
It's an old model already.
It is. I haven't used that model in, I can't even remember the name of it at that point. Like, And so, obviously we have things like archive, and we're trying to, you know, adopt some of the patterns of computer science. But in healthcare, there's kind of a cadence to things. There's a culture to how we process information, and it's on a completely different timeline. And so, like, when you talk about science funding, another similar situation is, like, I would get NIH grants and I would get the award notice, and then the check comes 18 months later, you know, and, right? And so by then I've got the entire experiment changed. So are you feeling like, yes, there's some challenges with the narrative and some of the political tension around the trust in institutions, but is that potentially going to lead to hopefully an upside? I'm trying to be optimistic that we will need to change the way that we conduct science, the way we fund science.
Yeah. So let's talk about two things. Now, number one, I think it's important to be clear that the pace of technological change of AI tools is not the pace of change in the world. Yeah. Because the world has human beings and organizations in it, and we're the ones who exercise judgment about what we're actually going to do with this stuff. And I find Arvind Narayanan and Sayash Kapoor's work on AI as normal technology to be sort of the only sane voice in this, you know, overhyped environment. So that's AI. And I think you have to recognize that it's moving fast, but then what it means for everything else. Like, you still actually need peer-reviewed journals and you know, papers that have the rigor of scientific review. And that is going to take more time than, you know, throwing something into a chatbot. That's number one. Number two is about the federal R&D system. And I think the challenge, I think, for those of us who are fighting for it is in the decades past, it has been, paradoxically, it's been the best system for publicly funded research in all of human history. Societies have been funding public research back to the ancient Egyptians. No one has done it like the United States.
And the ROI
States.
Is incredible. I think I've seen incredible. Data on, like, it's well
economically,
above industry.
Right? Economically, it's phenomenal in terms of quality of life, in terms of, you know, all of what healthcare looks like. It's phenomenal. At the same time, it was inadequate for the future that we're trying to go into. And so, you know, I think you just have to confront that and recognize that when I'm an optimist and I know this country is too big a deal to give up on. And so we have to build again. We have to get through this crisis and we have to build again. It's not about building back to what we had before, because what we need for the R&D capacity for the country is to be clear about what our great needs and our aspirations are, you know, now, not in 1945 when we sort of set the architecture. It evolved quite a lot in 80 years, but the fundamental bones were set in 1945. Yeah. Well, the world's pretty different. China, AI, the deep inequalities in our society that we have to deal with. So we've got a lot of, you know, the context is different. The same things fundamentally still matter. The reason societies back to ancient Egypt have invested in research, peace, prosperity, and health. Those are always the reasons. It's just how you achieve national security today in our world is different. Health can't be just about more cures. You can't just have more biology close this horrible gap in American health outcomes. The fact that there are three dozen countries with longer lifespans than our wealthiest country in the world is, I think, just a national embarrassment. And that's actually not going to get fixed even with AI. It's not going to get fixed by medicine, right? So you have to reconceptualize what it means to improve health. It's very different than what we've been doing for the last 80 years. I still want all the therapies, just to be clear, but it's not enough.
I will take a different opinion. I do believe some of these tools can. I think one of the things that drove me crazy in medical school is seeing what we know and what gets done, yeah, to your point, in our health system, right? Yeah. We have the resource, we have the capital, there is this giant gap between that. And, like, actually AI can.
Tell me about that. What do you have in mind?
For example, we published some work actually earlier this year across the University of Texas with Anthropic of identifying patients who have gaps in their care, in their cardiovascular care. Mm-hmm. So you now with AI can go through thousands and thousands of charts, both the structured and unstructured information in the notes, find these gaps in care and bring these patients in. This is, again, a gap between, we know these things, it has been impossible, right, to, you talk about a primary care doctor, for them to apply every guideline, they would need, you know, tens of hours, right? It doesn't fit but AI actually can apply those guidelines to every patient and do this. And so these gaps, again, this knowing-doing gap, right, is something where actually AI can move us in that direction. It can't go all the way.
No,
we will have other gaps.
I love that example. And I actually think this, one thing I really have struggled with is finding people who can, I find people who know so much about research and health, almost all biology and biomedicine, and then I find people who know so much about population health and health outcomes, but they're not, that's not a field where we have, we're acculturated to the idea that R&D can change how we do it. Right. It's been under-resourced. It's now tragically disrespected after the pandemic, despite the fact that these are the people that literally saved, you know, like I was living here, my home is right here, and I was here when the pandemic hit, and, you know, as our public health officials who shut down things in the Bay Area and saved a lot of lives. But what I always hear from the public health community is we just need resourcing, and I know they need resourcing, but we also have to find ways to bring innovation in to change the fundamentals in this area. So anyway, I think I'm happy to hear AI examples, but I think there are much deeper issues that we still have to get to.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we got work to do.
We do.
I mean, I think we're here to talk about and do the work. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the most exciting times. Again, we tend to trend optimistic to your point, but like...
Well, listen, we need that. We need that because I think if you just read the news, it's easy to give up, and you can't give up. And I do feel hopeful. It's why it's worth fighting for.
Well, I'm glad you're in the fight with us on this. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for the chance to talk.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Great to be with you guys.